athletic competition. It can easily be broken down into two parts: the minutes or hours it takes to complete the event, then weeks, months, and years of joy or heartbreak. Finally, the decades to analyze and debate it. From the press box to press row, Donald Ware will break it all down for you with an in-depth look at historically black college athletics, as well as the biggest news stories and newsmakers of the day. It's time to talk the talk with those who walk the walk. From the press box to press row, here's your host, Donald Ware.
Game 7 of the NBA Finals is going to take place on Sunday in Oklahoma City, and we've got plenty to discuss with respect to that matchup, with respect to where we are in the series, tied at 3 games apiece in the NBA Finals. Welcome to another edition of Box to Row. I am your host, Donald Ware. Joining us today on the program, the DC Defenders win the UFL championship, and Shannon Harris, the head football coach, or the head coach of the DC Defenders. He's a Tennessee State alum. He's going to join us today here on Box to Row. Also joining us today here on the program, I ran across something special that was happening between Kevin Alushala and the HU Showtime Marching Band, the Howard University Showtime Marching Band. A performance called Hallelujah at Howard, which you can view, as a matter of fact, right now on YouTube. And it is a special performance. Kevin Alushala, part of the group Pentatonics, it's an a cappella group. And we're going to discuss, I want to really talk about and dive into this today. I the collaboration, when this was presented, and then I had a chance to see the video. And I mean, this is, a cappella, if this is a different form of a cappella, is what his group Pentatonics and Kevin Alushala is about. So you don't want to miss that conversation, and we've got him right here today on the program. Look, you can participate on the program. Hit me up via X at DWare1, at DWare1, because we've got plenty to talk about. The NBA Finals, as mentioned, tied at 3 games apiece. What an exciting series. And coming into this series, I said, okay, I think OKC is going to win the series. I predicted or have said that OKC would win the series. I think that is in serious jeopardy. And later on in the program, I'm going to give you my thoughts and a prediction for Game 7. But what I did do was give Indiana a 40% chance of winning the series. Like a lot of people, nobody gave Indiana a shot to win this series, let alone, I mean, I heard gentlemen sweep, I heard sweep, I heard maybe it goes 6 games, but nobody was saying it was going to go 7 games, and certainly nobody was saying that Indiana could win this series. And I'm going to take you back even further to Game 4, because I thought in Game 4, Indiana had an opportunity to go up in this series. Remember, at home, Indiana had an opportunity to go up 3-1. And there was it was the latter part of the third quarter, maybe about 4 minutes, in the 4 minute mark or so, remaining in the third quarter, Indiana had a 10-point lead. And this was one of the things that also I saw that happened in Game 6, and I'm going to mention a little bit more about that. But Indiana had a 10-point lead, and Oklahoma City was reeling a little bit. Oklahoma City couldn't hit a shot. But Indiana could not further its lead. It may have gotten up to 12. It may have been a 12-point lead. But Indiana had an opportunity to grow the lead, perhaps as many shots as OKC missed. If Indiana could have capitalized on it, you would have been, you may have been talking about a 18 to 20-point lead again towards the end of the third quarter. And that's pretty hard to come back from. But because Indiana was unable to hit shots, and then OKC caught fire and started to hit some shots, and SGA went absolutely off, it enabled OKC to steal a game on the road to reset home court advantage back to OKC. And then what do we see happen in game five? We see OKC roar back. Certainly Indiana fought in game five. Had a good third quarter after Oklahoma City outscored Indiana in both the first and second quarters. And we saw the Pacers really pull this thing to within two in the fourth quarter. But then it was just a blowout. Jalen Williams went absolutely berserk, dropped 40 points. I mean, SGA did SGA things. And so now you have an opportunity or situation where the Thunder is up 3-2. But you've got to go back to Indiana. And I got to be honest with you, coming into that game, coming off of what I saw in game five, I mean, you can't always just say, okay, the moment, it's not just about what the team did in the previous game, because there's a lot of factors that go into this, namely home court advantage. So each of the teams split the first two games at home, and then OKC handled its business at home. But I just thought the momentum, but I think more importantly, what gave me pause, I didn't think that Indiana would have enough, especially with the calf situation of Halliburton. And so, you know, you've got that going in. You hear about the history of these calves going back to Kevin Durant, the calf deal he had in the 2019 NBA Finals, and he ultimately ruptured his Achilles tendon, and Golden State went on to lose that series. So you didn't know how severe, you know, and it was a game time decision that Halliburton was going to play. And then when he did play, you said, okay, how much is Tyrese Halliburton really going to give Indiana in this game? Well, from the onset, and the thing about this game, Indiana missed a lot of shots early. But again, so did OKC. Look, it was a situation. I think OKC hit a couple of free, or Indiana hit a couple of free throws, and it was the score at one point, I think it was like 10-2. OKC had gone. I mean, it wasn't like OKC was setting the world on fire either, but Indiana was missing a lot of shots. And then all of a sudden, Indiana settled down, came back, tied the game at 10, and then sort of went on this run. And really, when you look at what Indiana was able to do in this basketball game, okay, in the first quarter, it was a close ball game, 28-25. But it was the second quarter where Indiana absolutely went off. And I'm going to tell you what I thought was the key moment for Indiana. And I still didn't know if Indiana would win this ballgame. Yeah, ahead by 20 at halftime. But I'm going to tell you the key moment for me. If you remember in this ballgame in the second quarter where Halliburton got a steal on the left, what amounted to the left of the bottom sideline, if you will, got it about right at about midcourt, got it up the court, going towards the left, got it up the court, no look pass to Pascal Siakam, who jammed, I think he jammed it on Jalen Williams, absolutely crushed him on the dunk. But to me, what set that up was the previous play, because Halliburton had gone to the hole, there was a lot of contact, he didn't get a foul call, and he sort of just sat there for a second kind of flailing his arms a bit as if, you know, hey, why didn't you make that call? And I was thinking to myself right there, I'm like, all right, you got to get back. Because I want to see a game seven. Like, I'm not cheering for either team. I mean, if I was going for a team, I like the underdog story. I'm all about the underdog story. And so for me, it would be Indiana because nobody gave Indiana a chance. I should say, because I'm going to give you my prediction a little bit later on for game seven. But even though I said, okay, Indiana's got a 40% chance of winning the series, that's not saying that Indiana is going to win the series. And I thought that the Thunder would win the series. But that particular play, so he was able to get back on defense, play the passing lane in the OKC half-court set, get the steal, and then go back the other way. I thought that was a defining moment for Indiana in this game. I thought that the play, look, TJ McConnell, absolutely brilliant the last couple of games. This is something I've been looking to see from TJ McConnell throughout, not just in this particular series, but throughout the course of these playoffs. Because remember, McConnell was big for the Pacers last year, particularly against the Knicks. He brought an energy. And so he's brought that same energy the last couple. He's had some games here or in there, but he hasn't been consistent. With the last couple of games, he's been really, really good. And I think he was able to draw in game six from what he was able to do in game five. Now, of course, the Pacers did not win that game, but he brought such an energy, and not just an energy. He played well. He scored points. He made significant contributions for the Pacers. And so he carried that over because the Pacers really needed him. And what I liked is what Rick Carlisle did. And he had done some of this in previous games. He played both McConnell and Halliburton together, but more so in game six. And in particular, second, third quarter, out of necessity. Because with Halliburton having the injury and the calf injury, you don't want him exerting as much energy as he typically does, because he'll bring the ball up the court. Then he does those kind of stop and go moves, which is patented in his game. It gets him free a lot of times. He'll cross you up, all of that. McConnell was the one a lot of times dictating pace and the offense. But then Halliburton played off the ball a lot, so he wasn't having to do as much. So he knocked down big three-pointers. Halliburton's shots that Halliburton made were significant. He only had 14 points, but the 14 points that he had were significant, starting, I would say, with the first free throw of the game. Remember, it was a technical foul or something. It was, but he made that first free throw, right? And so I thought it was significant, those two playing together. You know, Siakam did his thing. Everybody contributed. Nembhard, Nesmith, it was just a contribution all around from the Pacers to win that game and force a game seven. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that today here on the program. Up next here on Box to Row, we're going to switch gears and we're going to talk to Kevin Alushala of the group Pentatonix and the collaboration with the Howard University Showtime Marching Band. Keep it locked.
More of Box to Row with Donald Ware is on the way.
Hey there, fellow travelers. It's me, the Hotel Wiz. Before you go anywhere, call me day or night for hotel rates too low to publish. I'll save you up to 75% on over 500,000 hotels across the globe. You see, I've already done the research, so you don't have to spend time online trying to find the best deal. That's up to 75% off. Just call me, the Hotel Wiz. It's a free call, and you get instant access to rates too low to publish with no cancellation fees.
Make a free call now and save up to 75% off your hotel rooms the next time you're going somewhere for business or pleasure. Call the Hotel Wiz now and get instant access to rates to load up publish. 800-811-3471. 800-811-3471. 800-811-3471. Call the Hotel Wiz right now for rates too low to publish at 800-811-3471.
Do you want to save money on your next flight? Then pick up the phone and call. That's right, call. Because the best prices are not online. They're with SmartFares. See, SmartFares has special deals with the airlines. When they have unsold seats, they use SmartFares to fill them. So you get airline tickets at crazy low prices. They have access to great prices and discounts at over 500 different airlines. Plus 300,000 hotels and rental car companies. Their prices are too low to publish online. With the extra money you'll save, you can book another trip or treat yourself to dinner or shopping. So stop searching all of those travel sites to find the lowest price on your next flight. Let one of our SmartFares expert travel agents find the best price for you. Call SmartFares today and get ready to see the world with a fat wallet.
800-313-7757. 800-313-7757. 800-313-7757. That's 800-313-7757.
You're listening to From the Press Box to Press Row.
From the Press Box to Press Row.
Box to
Box
row.
To Box to Row.
Box to Row.
Hard without you, I would die. So funny how since you've been gone, I'm singing hallelujah.
Let's continue here on the program. We're joined by a gentleman, as a matter of fact, and this gentleman and the Howard University Showtime Marching Band did a thing. And it was a great thing, as a matter of fact, so great that it was named Hallelujah at Howard. And this gentleman, as a matter of fact, part of the group Pentatonix, they are so awesome. Didn't know a lot, I gotta admit, didn't know a lot before. Got a press release from Sony about this project and know enough now and interested to learn more. And I'll tell you what, I'm super excited about this. Kevin Alushala joining us here on Box to Row. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
How did this come up? Like, and people have to watch. They have to watch this, right? Like, you have to go on YouTube and watch, you know, Google Kevin Alushala and Howard University Marching Band, and you'll see this. Hallelujah at Howard. How did this come about, Kevin?
Wow, thank you for that question. You know, I always wanted to make sure that students were a group that I reached, because university, college was so, so important to me. And so I got an opportunity to do a lunch and learn at Howard University with a lot of the students. And it was so amazing. What was a 45-minute conversation initially turned into a two-hour conversation where the students and I got very honest and vulnerable and raw about the things that we've been through. And I remember there was one student, this girl, who came to me afterwards, hugged me, and she said, "Look, I feel so seen and understood by your music and your message." So I knew it wasn't going to be a one-time visit. I wanted to build something further with Howard. And that's when we put our minds together. And that's how we put up Hallelujah at Howard University. And even from that, it wasn't just a musical partnership. It was a cultural moment where we could just be unapologetically who we are and just show the freedom, the love, and the joy that we have.
Man, that is so well said. So that's, So you didn't have necessarily a previous relationship with Howard, but this, you know, this coming together came about because of a speaking engagement you had, which is absolutely cool. So tell us a little bit about the music, your music, and what you do with Pentatonix, the group.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm the beatboxer of the group. We're an a cappella group, so we do not use any instruments behind what we do. So I provide the vocal percussion. So just to give you an example, so that's the stuff I do with the band.
Nice, man. That is really, really nice. You know, I'm going to tell you what's cool. So when I first started, you know, I went to your Instagram page, Tisha Campbell, like, did a whole thing to one of your songs. Man, that was like, And she was dope with it, man. She did the whole song. What did that mean? Talk about that.
Oh, my gosh. Tisha Campbell is one of the realest humans in this industry. Like, we actually DM'd afterwards and really got to know each other. And I was just super appreciative of how much she supports artists who are trying to do something different outside of maybe the mainstream genres. She really, really gave me a lot of inspiration and made me feel like what I was doing was something that was unique and necessary. So I'm super appreciative of her. And she didn't have to do that 2-minute video to Hallelujah. She didn't have to do that. And so just that's a testament to who she is.
Kevin Alushala, he's joining us here on the program. And as a matter of fact, as he mentioned, the beatboxer for Pentatonix and a collaboration, Hallelujah at Howard, a collaboration between he and the HU Showtime marching band. Kevin, can I take you back a little bit to the sing-off? Can I take you back to the sing-off?
Oh, let's go there.
Yeah.
Let's go there.
So was that 2011 NBC sing-off? You all ended up winning the competition. Speak to that, and what do you remember most about that time?
You know, it was such a formative time for myself and everybody in the band, because I think none of us thought that we were going to do a cappella as our career. I mean, everybody was doing separate music things that they were interested in. Like, for my Kirstie was a musical theater major. Scott was pursuing solo pop music. And for me, I was trying to go into medicine. I was a pre-med student at Yale. So for this to come together, it was a whole new world for all of us. But when we realized the sound that we had was super special and different, we wanted to go all the way with it. And to see us win and then in 2012 start to build this business through YouTube, it's been something that I don't think any of us expected, but it's been the joy of our lives to do this.
So let me ask you this. Do you plan, because this has only been what, I guess about a week or so since you've released this collaboration with the Howard University Marching Band. Is there any talk of doing anything collaboratively with other HBCU bands?
You know, I certainly hope so. I would love to do stuff with more HBCUs, colleges and universities in general, because, you know, I know a lot of those students, there's a lot of them that think, I don't know how to go into the arts. I don't know how to go into music. I don't know how to do the industry. It seems so daunting. And I would hope to be a bit of a mentor to a lot of those students that it can be done, but there are some things you have to think through before you really dive right in. So I would love to be somebody that people can look to in the college university space.
Kevin Alushala joining us here on the program. Again, the collaboration, Hallelujah at Howard with the HU Showtime Marching Band. I invite you to check it out, as a matter of fact, on YouTube. How did the group Pentatonix come together?
Three of them actually grew up together in Texas, Arlington, Texas. They were in show choir together. They were in all-state choir together. They were best friends. And then our bandmate Scott went to USC for a year. And while he was there, he heard about a cappella, joined the a cappella group there, and then found out about the TV show, The Sing Off, which was the a cappella TV competition we were on. And so that's when he said, you know what, why don't I get my two best friends, Kirstie and Mitch, to join me to possibly try out for this competition. And then they needed a beatboxer and a bass singer to round out the sound. So they found the bass singer through a mutual friend. And then me, my senior spring semester at Yale, I had this piece that I had made doing a cello boxing version of Mark Summers' Julio. And it went viral on the internet. And that's how the band found me. And they said, we'd love for you to fly out and meet us. So I did the day before the audition of the TV show. And the rest is history.
Wow. Did you ever think you would be doing this? Like, how does one go from that to what you're doing right now?
I had no plan ever to go into music. I thought I was going to be a doctor. I knew I was going to be Dr. Kevin Alushala, especially with my background, my dad being from Nigeria and a doctor, and my mom being from Grenada and being a nurse. I just always thought medicine was my path. So, you know, apparently God had different plans, and I'm glad I followed them because it's changed my life.
Absolutely. A couple of more thoughts with Kevin Alushala, who joins us here on the program. So who are some of the, I don't know, do you have a wish list maybe of artists that you'd like to work with?
Wow. For myself, I think John Batiste would be an amazing one. I always say he's like a musical alien who lives on his own world, just showing love, light, and harmony to the earth. It's just so cool to watch him do what he does. It's just amazing. I think Jacob Collier would be amazing. Shaboozy would be incredible. Gosh, I'd love to work with some Afrobeat artists. That'd be super fun. Yeah, I mean, it runs the gamut, truly.
Yeah. So maybe either for you or for the group, what's your next project?
Oh, after this one? Yeah. Well, the band's always working on music. That is for sure. And, you know, we're always around during the holiday season, so you probably will see us during that time. But for me, I'm always tinkering with a new sound. And so I've already been working with some, like, you know, precursor ideas to what could be the next wave for me. So I'm really, really excited about that. But I also hope to tour at some point, because I'd really love to meet the fans that have been kind of enjoying my new sound. And so I'm excited to meet them and be connected to them.
Yeah, I think what's interesting, I can't remember, it may have been an article that I was reading, and it made mention of the fact that, you know, the sound, a cappella, it's not your typical, what people may typically think about, you know, that genre of music. So if you could sort of describe, you know, what you all sound in particular is.
That's a very good question. So for us, when it comes to a cappella, you know, there are many types of a cappella groups. You can look at Take Six. You can look at Manhattan Transfer, which is more jazz. Take Six, I'd say more of a more gospel. But for us, we try to take a more pop spin on our vocals, right? We take some of the most probably iconic songs like Hallelujah or Sound of Silence and try to give it a spin that feels very epic with our vocals. And so it's been such a fun challenge and a fun opportunity to do something that people probably didn't expect that vocals could do.
Kevin Alushala joining us here on the program. Again, you've got to check it out. Hallelujah at Howard, a collaboration with the HU Showtime Marching Band. I promise you, you got to check it out. May change your life, as a matter of fact, as he joins us here on the program. Kevin, we appreciate the time. Continued success in all you do.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the interview.
Kevin Alushala of Pentatonix. Check out he and the HU Marching Band. Up next here on Box to Row, I'm switching gears and talking Game 7 of the NBA Finals.
You're listening to From the Press Box to Press Row.
Hey, Patrick, right here. This being your fifth Super Bowl, what do you remember most about this whole process with respect to the first Super Bowl? And when I say the whole process, I mean the preparation, not only for the game, but the media and all of that, as opposed to now. How do you kind of compare that? Is it still kind of fun for you?
Yeah, it's still fun. I mean, every Super Bowl is its own experience. But I think more than anything, it's just preparing, because you know the process. You know what it takes throughout the week. And it gives you more experience and more calm, where you're not worried and you just continue to work to be the best version of yourself you can be and learn from your previous Super Bowls, and hopefully you can play even better in the game when you get out there on Sunday.
Ron Washington, the manager of the Los Angeles Angels, you're old school. So you've instituted this deal where the players are not allowed to have cell phones in the locker room.
Well, you got a young group and you're just trying to get some cohesiveness going on. What does goes on the inside of that clubhouse is our sanctuary. I really don't want to have a whole lot to say about that, because it's out there and it's out there improperly. I'm going to leave that at that. I don't want to talk about that.
I got you. But I like it. I like it, Ron. I like it.
I appreciate that. That's because you have a sane mind.
Box to Row live on Radio Row. We're here at Super Bowl 59 in New Orleans. And I'm going to tell you what, we've got a very special guest, right? He was coming over here to talk to us, right? Everybody wanted a piece of him. And now we're able to talk with him. He is the one and only Drew Brees.
Just hanging out, having a good time, enjoying Media Row. Join the city.
Yeah.
You having a good time?
I'm having a great time. 15 years ago today, the Saints won the Super Bowl.
Man, That was a pretty epic time. It was a pretty special time. You know, that was an incredible journey that 2009 season. Just the whole experience was unbelievable. It was surreal, and the city deserved it. The fan base deserved it. Not a dry eye in the house. It was unbelievable.
Kelvin Sampson, the head men's basketball coach at Houston.
Being raised in Pembroke and the Lumbee Nation was always a badge of honor. But getting the eagle feather is a sign of achievement and respect, and I think how you treat other people. Never forgetting where you came from. I grew up in a time when there was segregation. My dad taught and coached in an all-Indian conference. I mean, coming from that area, I learned a lot of life lessons, but getting the eagle feather is a tremendous honor. But you know right away, it's something you share with a lot of other people.
Here with Stephen Curry, your progress from Davidson to now with Golden State.
Where I've come from in high school into a small D1 college at Davidson, and it's a great story, and I'm just having fun, you know, living my dream and riding the ride.
Dave Roberts, manager of the LA Dodgers, to be person of color and be the manager of the Dodgers, what does that mean to you?
There's not many of us in baseball to do things the right way, to hopefully give other people of color opportunity. Hopefully it just paves the way. So I think that for me, I definitely look at it as responsibility, but something I'm willing to undertake.
Michael B. Jordan.
And I think it's a testament to, you know, what HBCUs mean to people, you know, and having that community and culture and shining a light on the universities, you know what I'm saying, in a real way, and creating a pipeline from these kids in high school and making them feel good about wanting to land at HBCU. We have high talent, and often it's gone and shipped out to other places. It's never poured back into the community. So if we can create an environment that's cool and a beacon of light, and people want to feel like they want to be here, and so putting it on the national stage is really big. You know, most of the time these kids don't get televised games, you know what I'm saying, so be able to put them on Turner in a real way was really, really important. And then the brands and then the sponsors, you know what I'm saying? And getting, you know, the NBA, you know, scouts and looks to come in and hopefully like build this thing bigger.
Snoop Dogg is on the mic. Pay attention.
I appreciate the love that I get, and I appreciate the support of hip hop. And it's given me back that same love in return, you know, for the amount of years that I've been doing it. I've always went into it with the same, you know, spirit of I make music for the people. I make it go for them, and I always make them a part of it. I never separated myself and tried to be a star. I've always wanted to be one of the people that you can look to as somebody that was, you know, like your uncle because of the way that I treat people. And I feel like my career is representative of that. That's why the longevity is there. That's why the love is there. And that's why I maintain the status of, you know, being relevant for so many years.
That is the voice of Kevin Durant.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm just, you know, trying to get better every single day. We've been through a lot as a team, and I enjoy playing with a great group of guys. So, you know, I'm just trying to enjoy every moment of it.
Kevin Hart joins us here.
Right now, I'm on cloud nine. This is the time where I'm in demand, so you make the best of it. You pick great projects, you get behind them, and you put them out. And the goal is to keep them coming. So that's making sure that you're in control of your destiny. And right now, I am.
From the Press Box to Press Row is the sports talk show that is the voice and the talk of HBCU sports, with a flair for pro sports talk and entertainment. Check the show out online at BoxToRow.com.
That's Box to Row, real, relevant radio. Thoughts and a prediction for Game 7 of the NBA Finals taking place on Sunday in Oklahoma City. This has been a phenomenal Finals, but not only that, it's really been a really, really good playoffs. I'm interested to see once the final numbers come out in terms of viewership, but this has been absolutely fantastic. So this is a really tough game to pick because you and this is the thing, like, you can't always look at what happened in the previous game to predict what's going to happen in the next game, because now we're going back to Oklahoma City and it makes all the difference in the world. I'll give you a prime example. If you go back to game 5, a guy like Wiggins coming off the bench for OKC, knocks down, he hits 14 points, knocks down a bunch of threes. In game 6 in Indianapolis, he only gives you 5 points. You needed that kind of spark, gave you that kind of spark in game 5, could not find that spark for game 6. Going back home for game 7, I think makes a bit of a difference. It makes, well, not a bit, but I think it makes a lot of difference. The crowds behind you, your comfort zone is more there playing at home. So I think it definitely makes a difference. So that's kind of just one example. Going back to Oklahoma City, I think, look, I talked a lot in the first segment, really, about Indiana and what Indiana did specifically and more so from an offensive perspective. Now, if you look at OKC, OKC wasn't the typical OKC that we've seen throughout these playoffs and specifically in these finals. I wondered where the defense... Now, you could look at the counter and say, okay, Rick Carlisle and his staff came up with a way to really attack OKC, but I just think it was more than that. You just didn't see OKC come to play. That's what it was more so to me. It wasn't that they laid down or anything like that. They just didn't have the energy. I don't know if it was a lot of it was spent in game five. But look, Jalen Williams, and this is the thing that I've talked about with respect to OKC, and that's why I thought, that's why I gave Indiana at least a puncher's chance in this series. Because, look, OKC has lulls, and I've talked about this, right? I mean, really, Indiana does too, because Indiana goes sometimes without hitting shots, and that's happened a couple of times in this series. I mentioned it to start the game in game six, and then also in game four, when again, the Pacers had a 12-point lead towards the latter part of the third quarter, couldn't hit shots. Neither team was hitting shots, and then suddenly OKC started hitting shots and Indiana couldn't. So both teams have had lulls, but in particular, OKC, the Thunder has had lulls too. Like, let's look back. Let's not forget, the Thunder lost a game by 42 points. Now, it was against Minnesota. They took care of Minnesota. The Thunder took care of Minnesota 4-1. The fact remains that the Thunder lost a game by 42 points in the playoffs. Okay? But I want to also go back to the series of the Western Conference Finals when Oklahoma City, in a very similar scenario, meaning, okay, the Thunder had gone up 3-2 on Denver. Denver comes back in Denver, wins that game, and then OKC wins the game going away. And really crushed the Nuggets in that game to now get to the NBA Finals. The setup is similar. I don't know if Game 7 is going to be similar. I don't think it will be. I don't think it's going to be a blowout on either side. But I would say this. Jalen Williams, he had the 40 points in Game 5. He has had these games throughout the playoffs, really. He's been better in the finals, and especially before game six. He was really good games 2, 3, 4, and 5. And especially in game five when he had the 40 points. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander's been like consistent throughout the course. I mean, he's had a couple of games maybe here and there that weren't great. He only had 21 points. I think more importantly, in game six, he turned the ball over 8 times. That's very uncharacteristic. But then again, if you go back to game five, look at how many times Halliburton turned the ball over and the Pacers as a whole. Really, Nembhard, I thought in game five, boy, there were like consecutive plays, maybe 4 consecutive plays. And it seemed like on 4 of those plays, Nembhard turned the ball over 3 times. So, you know, the turnovers had to be cut down. And that's exactly what happened as the Pacers only turned the ball over 12 times in the ballgame compared to the whatever it was, 24 times or whatever it was in game 5. Meanwhile, Oklahoma City turned the ball over 21 times. And Gilgeous-Alexander, who has the ball in his hands the majority of the time, as the guy who runs the point, had 8 of those turnovers. I think, you know, even more so with the 8 turnovers. He only had 2 assists in the ballgame, but you can understand that because OKC only scored 91 points in the game, shot only 42% from the field, and only 27% from 3-point range. But this is the thing about it. as well as Indiana played, Indiana actually, from a field goal percentage perspective, so I said 42% for the Thunder. The Thunder actually shot 41.9% rounded up to 42, whereas Indiana shot 41.3% from the field. So Indiana missed a bunch of shots as well. The difference is that Indiana was 36% from three-point range. And so that's sort of the difference in the ball game, 15 of 42. And, you know, Indiana cannot afford to have points in the ball game where it misses shots. Indiana missed a lot of shots. Now, as well as Indiana played, or as well as the Pacers played overall, and when I say overall, I mean from a defensive perspective. I mean from hitting timely shots perspective. I mean from the second and third quarter perspectives, Indiana didn't shoot well from a statistical perspective overall, and you don't want that to carry over. Now, I think when you look at the guys that your key guys, a lot of those guys right around, you know, 40% or so, but you got to figure, you know, and I'll be interested to see how Jalen Williams comes out because, I mean, look, Jalen Williams in this ball game, he only had 16 points coming off a 40-point performance, right? But I think more so, he was only 6 of 13 from the floor. So he only took 13 shots. 6 of 13 is, you know, right, it's sub 50%. I think it's like 46% or something like that. From a field goal percentage standpoint, it's not bad. You got to figure he's going to take more than 13 shots, but I'm going to be interested to see how he really comes to play. And I think a lot of that had to do with the way that some of it had to do with the way that the Pacers played defense, but I think some of it also was that he, meaning Jalen Williams, just he only got 13 shots. He's got to be able to get more shots. Same thing with SGA. 15 shots? It's not enough shots. Again, game one, he took 30 shots. He made 14 of those 30 shots in game one, even though the Thunder lost that game. He's got to take more. So it's equivalent. He took and made exactly half of the shots that he took in game one. He was 7 of 15. He's not going to turn the ball over 8 times. The Thunder are going to go back and look at the film. So the Thunder are going to make adjustments in this ball game. So that's one thing. And I think Indiana has to make shots. And that's sort of, to me, been where we haven't talked about that enough, because I think what we've really talked about, or what I've talked about at least the last couple of weeks, is look at what Indiana has been able to do in even being in this series when nobody gave the Pacers a chance. And look at the way that, whether it's been Halliburton, whether it's been Siakam, you know, whether it's been Nesmith from a defensive perspective and hitting timely shots, or Nembhard more so from a defensive perspective as well. Obi Toppin off the bench has been super consistent. Like, he's been excellent. And then TJ McConnell, in particular the last several games, has played extremely well. But Indiana has missed shots, and that's going to be key in game 7. Can the Pacers knock down shots? Can either one of these teams avoid lulls? That's going to be the key. Those are going to be some of the keys in this game. Now, as far as a prediction is concerned, I really wrestled with this because you don't want to get too caught up in what happened in the last game. Ask OKC that, because OKC went from possibly winning the series, which I thought the OKC would. I thought it would win in Indiana, in Indianapolis, to getting blown out. So you don't want to, you don't want to necessarily judge by what happened in the last game. And so I'm not going to do that. I think Halliburton will be fine from an injury perspective. I just wonder how some of these guys are going to get on the road in a game seven. Game seven is different. It's different. It's different. And it's not like OKC. The OKC players have played in a lot of game sevens per se. I mean, Pascal Siakam, we know, you know, what he brings to the table for Indiana. But the difference is OKC is at home. And I think that's going to make all the difference in the world. I think this is going to be a close ball game. But I think that OKC is going to rely upon the crowd, that energy. We know SGA is going to be better. He always rebounds from a subpar game. And I think Jalen Williams is going to be better as well as some of the other players, because nobody really from OKC played well in this game at all. So my prediction will be that the Thunder win Game 7 and win their first NBA title. As the Thunder, we know the Supersonics, Seattle Supersonics, won the title in 1979. Hit me up via X at DWare1. Up next here on the program, we're talking with DC Defenders head coach Shannon Harris.
Have you ever met a single person in your life that enjoys paying taxes? No, no one does. If you can't sleep at night because you have a huge problem with the IRS, I've got some free advice for you. This service is strictly limited to individuals that owe the IRS $10,000 or more in back taxes. And if you qualify, we can guarantee that you won't be writing a big fat check to the IRS, or our services cost you nothing. The first 100 people that call today will get a free tax consultation worth $500. Stop worrying about your IRS problem. We can help you, we promise. Call the tax doctor right now. I mean right now, to learn more.
800-245-3052. 800-245-3052. 800-245-3052. That's 800-245-3052.
We track down the names making news in sports, from the press box to press row. It's Donald Ware, from the press box to press row.
Let's continue here on Box to Row. The DC Defenders win the UFL championship game. Joining us, as a matter of fact, right here, is the head coach of the DC Defenders, Shannon Harris, in his first season as the head coach. And of course, he's had coaching stops along the way: Virginia State, Alcorn, Alabama State, and Tennessee State as well. He's an alum, as a matter of fact, played quarterback back in the day at Tennessee State, as he joins us here on the program. Coach Harris, congratulations. Welcome to Box to Row.
Thank you. I appreciate it, man. And thanks for having us on. And yeah, you said it, a lot of few stops, HBCU world, and you know, had an opportunity to do an internship with the Tennessee Titans, and that was amazing for me. The relationship that I built and created by doing that was amazing. So I still keep in touch with a lot of those guys, you know, daily, weekly, you know, monthly, however you may say it. But so all of those things, man, kind of helped me to be where I am today.
Yeah, and I think we're gonna talk about the championship game and the season. But to your point, I think that's an interesting place to start, because this is in part what the UFL is about. And you've gotten your opportunities, your college football, as you mentioned, that whole time. You had the opportunity with the Tennessee Titans. So just speak to the opportunity to be part of the UFL, and then how that could open up some other doors.
Yeah, I'll tell you, the UFL, our league, is very unique in this, you know, give so many people opportunities, not just the players, but coaches. I mean, you know, our equipment people, trainers and strength and conditioning, you know, for that matter, even the referees, everybody, you know, is always getting those opportunities outside of, you know, playing and coaching and doing all the things that people do within the league. So the league is a great league. And I tell you, so many people benefited from it. Even the NFL benefit from it because these players are already game ready. They're contact ready. You know, they already been hit a lot. So by the time they get to camp and do things like that for the NFL, they've already had those hits on their body. So I tell you, like I said, the league itself is amazing. Create a lot of opportunity for everyone. And that's the part what's amazing about it.
Yep, maybe even some of the camera angles, some of the rules to that point that the NFL has came from the UFL, no doubt. So how did you get involved? I guess you've got a long-time relationship now with, of course, Reggie Barlow, who's now the head coach at Tennessee State, who was previously the coach of the D.C. Defenders. I'm sure that's how kind of you came into the UFL.
Yeah, Barlow and I, have developed a great relationship and have become really good friends. And that's kind of how it happened for me, getting into the league as well, because when he had the job and we all came in in 2023, had some success, went to the championship game in the XFL. Last year, not as good. And I tell you, our GM, Vaughn Hutchins, did a great job of revamping our roster, getting it back to what it was in 2023. But right before Barlow took the job at Tennessee State, it was one of those things that, I told my man, I appreciate him going back to my school and taking over that program, because what a better person for it. And then, it was like one of those things to where, he gave me the keys to here and talked to our president and everyone else and said, the best person for this job would be Shannon. So, and I told him I appreciate that for giving me that opportunity. And, this is where we are now.
Yeah. Can you speak to that? Like, you take over, maybe a week or so before the start of the season. That had to be sort of a challenge.
Yeah, I tell you, though, but, I've had that question asked a good bit now. And so, when you're preparing for this to be a head coach for the last 5 years of your career, you kind of waiting for that moment, right? And they always say that the cliche thing to say is always you stay ready, you don't have to get ready, right? So for me, that's the thing that I continue to do, is to stay ready for that moment and be ready for it. And when it presented itself, I was ready to take off. And having been familiar with the team itself, the culture of the team, and everyone with our surroundings made it easier. Everyone around each other. Our motto became us, we, and ours. It was nothing like about one individual, So we all kind of rallied behind each other and just, took off from there.
Shannon Harris, just completed his first season as the head coach of the DC Defenders, who won the UFL championship this year. He joins us here on Box to Row. Your thoughts on the game and winning that championship?
We knew it was going to be a tough battle in the playoff, in that first round, and then getting to the championship. The biggest thing was making sure mentally we were there, physically we were there. And so all of that was great. We did a good job of critiquing our schedule on the back end of our schedule, especially once we clinched the playoff in week 8. So we did a good job of, taking the pads off when we needed to, and giving our guys an opportunity to have their body recover. But we still made sure guys were doing the right thing in the weight room, and then, also getting that treatment because we still had two more games. We know playoff football is totally different than regular season. So we got very physical in practice each week throughout the course leading up to that game. So and those guys bought into it. They embraced it, and so once they did that and did all those things the right way, we knew that we had a great opportunity to win both of those games, the first round of playoff and then in the championship game against Michigan.
What did you learn about yourself as, I believe, a first-time head coach, right, on any level? What did you learn about yourself?
Well, getting to be able to make sure that, on all phases, I've been a special team coach before as well. So I've already had that opportunity to work with defensive guys and knowing how to talk with the defensive guys and things like that. But even when I was the quarterback coach in the last 2 years before leading up to this season, I was always developing that relationship with defensive players, you know, as well, because, you know, knowing that, you know, one day I want to be a head coach, right? So guys, you know, kind of already knew sometimes and oftentimes, like, coaches only just deal with their side of the ball. Don't touch the defense. Well, for me, you know, uniquely, that, I mean, I want to be a head coach one day, right? So I would always stay involved with special teams, even when I was coaching quarterbacks. So I wanted to get to know each player on our team, because I need to know, like, you know, how we can have that back and forth. If they need to come talk to me about our offense or whatever going on, or whatever it may have been, you know? So I tell you, playing quarterback, that's kind of like something that you do second nature, as kind of you develop that team chemistry with everyone. And so me just going back to my roots of playing and those things, you know, was kind of easy for me to just transition over there. And the biggest challenge for me was just, you know, the game management of the game. You know what I'm saying? The players engagement and things like that was easy for me. It was just the game management of everything. And so, you know, that was a week by week thing within its own self, from a game management standpoint. But, you know, we had a good coach. We have a great coaching staff. So we were all able to, you know, I was able to lean on a lot of guys for that, you know, and that helped me out for sure.
Shannon Harris, the head football coach of the DC Defenders, joining us for a couple of more moments here on the program. What do you remember about those days at playing quarterback specifically at Tennessee State?
I tell you, we had a really good team. We had some really good coaches. A lot of our guys I know that coach when I was there, either in the NFL, you know, they're coaching Power Five, or now it's Power Four football somewhere. And some guys, you know, probably head high school coaches or principals or athletic directors somewhere in high school. But I just remember we have a good coaching staff, and then our players, you know, we had a really good roster. And the journey was fun, you know, competing and battling against guys like Tony Romo. We had some battles against each other at Eastern Illinois. And so a lot of high scoring games. And so just all those things, having fun with those guys and competing out there, winning games, of course. And so, you know, to see how those guys rallied behind me, it's kind of like how our team did against Jordan this past weekend in the championship game. When he didn't win MVP, the entire team just kind of rallied behind him, right? So that was kind of the same way with my team that, you know, at Tennessee State. Those guys rallied behind me every game.
Yeah, and then I think what's great about the UFL is it, you know what it is. Like, you're going to get other opportunities. It's not like, okay, you go to a spot and then people are salty because you move on. This is what, in part, this is about. So sort of maybe what's next for you? What's your ultimate goal? Are you ultimately looking to be a head coach in the National Football League, in college? What's your ultimate goal, and maybe what's next for you?
Yeah, the ceiling is still high, you know. There's no cutoff yet. And, you know, as long as I'm willing to still learn and grow, you know, ultimately, I want to go into the NFL and coach at that level, wherever that may take me, because that's the highest level of football for us, right? So wherever it may be within the NFL, that's the ultimate goal. And then, you know, wherever the good Lord lead us from there, we'll go there, you know, and let the chips lay where they may. But ultimately, yeah, that's a big goal for me, and we'll see how it go.
And, of course, the D.C. Defenders, UFL champions, of course, knocked off Michigan 58-34 in the UFL championship game, just completing his first season as the head coach of the Defenders. Shannon Harris, Tennessee State alum, joins us here on Pox to Row. Coach Harris, appreciate the time. Continued success to you and the Defenders.
Thank you. I appreciate it greatly. And thanks for having us on.
DC Defenders head football coach Shannon Harris joining us here. And we'll see what is ultimately next in his immediate future. Look, my time is about up. I thank you for yours. Thank you to Shannon Harris. Also, thank you to Kevin Alushala for joining us today here on Box to Row. For more information on the program, you can visit our website, which, as a matter of fact, is under construction, but still operable, BoxToRow.com. Don't forget Box to Row's 20-year celebration going to take place August the 20th in Raleigh. Mark it on your calendars. And always remember to support those that support you. Box to Row is produced by DW Communications. With no costume jewelry on, but it's happening every single weekend.